This morning from Luke, chapter 13, verses 1 through 9. At that very time, there were some present who told him about the Galileans, whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. He asked them, "Do you think that because these Galileans suffered in this way, that they were worse sinners than the other Galileans? No, I tell you. But unless you repent, you will all perish as they did." Or those 18 who were killed when the Tower of Siloam fell on them, do you think that they were worse offenders than all the others living in Jerusalem? No, I tell you. But unless you repent, you will all perish just as they did. Then he told this parable. A man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came looking for fruit on it and found none. So he said to the gardener, "See here, for 3 years I've come looking for fruit on this tree, and I still find none. Cut it down. Why should it be wasting the soil?" He replied, "Sir, let it alone for one more year until I dig around and put manure on it. If it bears fruit next year, well and good. But if not, you can cut it down." The word of the Lord.
We are richly blessed today to have to be able to bring to the teaching to us Patty Waddell. Patty is an incredible example of servant leadership and sacrificial love as she has led Joseph's house for a number of years in a way that is truly awe-inspiring. And I know every time that she comes here, she offers thoughts that are inspiring and thought-provoking. And we welcome you, Patty, and we're so, so glad you're here with us today.
Thank you ever so much, Kevin. And good morning, Eighth Day. And just right off the top, let me thank you for your generous support of Joseph's House this year and for so many, many years, and for inviting me this morning to share with you something that really matters to me. And so let me just dive right in. Over the years, I think many of you have heard me say that I actually have very little faith of my own. What faith I do have is mostly borrowed. I borrow from David Hilfiker and from Fred Taylor, from Harold Vines, from Mike Hopkins and Stephanie Harding, from the many residents at Joseph's House and the staff over so many years. And I borrow faith from African-American writers and activists like Bernice Reagan and Sweet Honey in the Rock. There's a young womanist, a theologian, and anti-racism activist whose name is Christina Cleveland. If you've never run into her, you'll be pleased to meet her on the internet. And for me, Reverend William Barber. And I borrow faith from the people I've known and know at L'Arche. So this is me saying I have very little faith. I borrow faith from others. It's pretty true. But recently I came across a reflection by Rabbi Abraham Heschel, and it got my heart's attention, and here it is. Faith is an endless pilgrimage of the heart. Faith is an endless pilgrimage of the heart. Audacious longing, burning songs, daring thoughts, an impulse overwhelming the heart and usurping the mind, these, he says, are all a drive toward serving the divine, who, these are all a drive toward serving the divine, who rings our hearts, who rings our hearts like a bell. My understanding of faith has been too narrow, because surely the divine has rung my heart like a bell. Surely my heart has been overwhelmed again and again all these years at Joseph's house. With confidence, I can say that all these years, I have been a pilgrim. I didn't consciously start out as a pilgrim, but very gradually I've become aware that I am a pilgrim. I've been on a path that has broken my heart and given me joy, love beyond anything I could have imagined, stoked my self-doubt, helped me notice where and when I'm asleep, made me want to wake up, and changed me. Changed me. A longtime nurse and early AIDS activist who's now a teacher of deep listening at Joseph's House, her name is Priscilla Norris. When we get new staff and volunteers, Priscilla asks them to notice if they're coming to the house as a tourist or a pilgrim. As a tourist or a prisoner, a sophisticate, or a pilgrim. Why? Because it matters so much, she tells them, how we meet, how we accompany, how we serve, how we behold one another. It matters very much. On this pilgrim journey, I regularly meet up with, I've just said it and I'll say it again, intense self-doubt and deep longing for something that's just out of my reach. On this path where I've been blessed with heartbreaking sorrow and heartbreaking love, over time, right here, my awareness has begun to open to the cost of racism in its countless forms to all of us, including white people, definitely to me. Not long ago, I wouldn't have been aware enough to feel grief at how the structures, the worldview that maintains white supremacy and benefits me in ways I mostly don't notice, shackle and diminish us all. Shackle and diminish us all, robbing us of our full humanity, those who currently benefit and those who pay the greatest cost. So 30 years ago, it's almost 30 years, as I was just approaching the place where my pilgrim path met up with Joseph's house, I felt urgently motivated to be in solidarity with people with AIDS. The world was mean, and it wasn't just that. They suffered so much. I wanted to stand with the many, mostly gay men at that time who had HIV and AIDS. I became a buddy down at the Whitman Walker Clinic. I don't know if you already know this. I feel like I might have said it before. I sought out Mother Teresa's Gift of Peace hospice at the time. There was a sister there, a nun, who met me. So I walk in, and this is the convent over there on Otis Street. I walk in, this nice sister says to me, I would like you to sew shrouds for us. And she was anticipating that many people would die there, and that after death, a person's body would leave the place in a dignified way. So I went down to G Street Fabrics and I bought a big bolt of heavy white cotton. And I remember sewing these shrouds, kind of inventing it as I went along, in the house that I shared with Connie Ridgway at the time. They say that sometimes, on a pilgrim's way, a shepherd or a shepherdess will come to guide us for a while. And they say, too, that as we walk that pilgrim way, it's not uncommon for us to hear what is sometimes called a beautiful question. Ron Holmes became my first shepherd at Joseph's house, and the beautiful question he asked me was, "Will you come and meet my family?" I met him, young African-American man, at Christ House after church one Sunday morning, and he invited me to come and have lunch with his family, and I accepted. He took me to Joseph's house where he lived. He explained what Joseph's house was about, who it was for. And at that table, there was such a sense of generous welcome and ease. No shame and no fear. There was a palpable sense of belonging. So I got, you already can guess this, but you know how a nonprofit just starts out, or a mission starts? You really don't want a bunch of new volunteers all excited to come and join your mission right away. I wasn't that welcome, but I came back the next day and the next day. I knew that I wanted to belong to these people and to this place, and I have never left. There was another shepherd, his name was Hugh. His beautiful question for me was, "Patty, why don't you lie down?" He taught me perhaps the most precious lesson I've ever learned as a pilgrim at Joseph's house. We don't have to be an expert. We don't have to be anyone special to be of comfort and encouragement to a person in great need. We only need to want to be there just as we are. I'll always remember Hugh. I was living at Joseph's house by then, helping Lois Wagner, David's friend and colleague, to keep the community knitted together day by day. Lois directed the Community of Hope Clinic, and she lived at Joseph's house, and I lived there too, and I was working at Intelsat up the road on Connecticut Avenue. So this is something I know you know. I know it's true here in Eighth Day too. When even one or two people's intention is to actively hold and nurture and love this community and every individual in it, every day, in every interaction, the community becomes more buoyant, more vital, more resonant, and it can hold more of everything, sorrow and joy. Lois and I took turns staying awake with the men at night in 4-hour shifts. And Hugh watched TV all night long, mostly old westerns. He was exhausted because he was afraid to fall asleep lest he die. 1 hour on my 4-hour shift, I brought Hugh and me some ice cream and I sat beside him on the bed. We watched an old black and white Western, and he nodded off from time to time and jerked himself awake to stop himself from falling off the bed. So I moved closer to him so that he could lean on me for support. And then I got sleepy. Hugh said, "Patty, why don't you lie down?" I accepted his invitation. I laid down on his narrow twin bed, my back to the wall, my head on his pillow, and I fell asleep. When I woke up, Hugh's bone-thin back was snuggled warm against my body. We were spooning. His snoring had awakened me. Hugh had found the courage to lie down and let himself sleep. This is perhaps the most precious lesson I ever learned at Joseph's house, that being with someone who's suffering or dying can be very intimate. And we don't have to be an expert or someone special to make a difference for someone and help to ease their suffering. Some say that pilgrimage is about a kind of longing, about acknowledging that part of us is seeking new life, that on this pilgrim path, we seek hope and healing, beauty and truth. Hope and healing and beauty and truth. All these I received from Hugh. David Hilfiker is a shepherd for me. I wouldn't have been able to stay or begin to recognize the abundant gifts of my Joseph's house path were it not for David. And something I'm still learning from him is about the gift and the truth of not judging a person, any person, for anything. Over time, because of David's way of being in the world, I've learned how, this is amazing for me, a very judgmental person in my heart, in case you didn't know, I've learned how even expressing disappointment in a person's choices or actions, such as when they pick up drugs or alcohol and need to leave Joseph's house, expressing my disappointment for them only adds to the pain and confusion that's already there. So over time, I've learned gradually, imperfectly, to be more clear about what needs to happen now and less disappointed that it does need to happen when I ask a person to leave the house as a consequence of their drug use or alcohol use. There was another important guide, I would say a shepherdess for me. Mary Daniel, Sister Mary Daniel, our first executive director, shepherded me with strong intention. Her beautiful question was, Patty, can you see how much Ralph loves his fish? She would always invite, never insist that a person participate in a group activity, even when the participation was expected. Ralph was a very anxious man, so anxious that he walked on tiptoe, ready to run, ready to spring at any time. During our community meetings, when the rest of us were there in the living room, Ralph hovered on the porch smoking, or sometimes just at the threshold of the living room. She would invite him to join us, but she respected how impossible it was for him to join the group. Over time, Ralph did bring a chair closer to the threshold and participated in his way, and she welcomed his efforts. He had such a hard time communicating with people, and it was so easy for many of us to give up on him and avoid him. So Sister Mary Daniel took me down to Ralph's room one day, knocked on the door and said, "Ralph." When he heard her voice, Ralph let us in. Mary Daniel wanted me to see Ralph's beautiful aquarium, which in fact he'd been sitting in front of enjoying the fish just as we came down. She wanted me to associate something beautiful with Ralph, to see him open and delighted and engaged by the beauty of those fish. "Can you see how much Ralph loves these fish?" she said. "Can you see how beautifully he takes care of them?" Upstairs with others, Ralph was mostly guarded and often angry. And then I learned that Mary Daniel went with Ralph to the pet store to buy the tank and the accessories and the fish, adding to, the collection from time to time. And she taught me something so important about being a leader. She looked for and she found what was most alive in a person who was hurting, who was dying. And she nurtured that aliveness, giving of her time and her creativity and not hesitating to spend money on something temporary, beautiful, and life-giving. My late husband, Pierre, who some of you knew, was a steady shepherd for me at Joseph's house. I wish I had apprenticed myself to his guidance with much deeper attention. Pierre's beautiful question to me was, "Will you marry me?" All my life, and all my pilgrim, I've got it written down here, all my life. It's so true, that is my relationship with Joseph's house, that it is, the pilgrimage is my life. All my, I'll read it as I wrote it. As my life and pilgrimage at Joseph's house continued year after year, I've become more aware of and humbled by the cost of my great love for my community. I felt I was doing pretty well without a love in my life. Joseph's house was my true love, seemed to ask for everything I had to give. I wanted to give it. And then Pierre came into the picture. He made things easier for me, better. Everybody I loved liked him. He could fix things. For an old dude, he was easy on the eye. Pierre asked me to marry him, and we got married. And what happened was, even after we were married, Joseph's house always came first for me. Soon, Pierre and I were living parallel lives within the community. We were both disappointed and lonely. And we both loved Joseph's house. The cost to Pierre and me of Joseph's house coming first in my life was too high. But I didn't know how to do it differently. I wish I had known. Even now there's dust in my throat when I remember our marriage. There's words from an Ash Wednesday blessing by Jan Richardson that speak to me, and they are, "All those days you felt like dust, like dirt, as if all you had to do was turn your face to the wind and be scattered by the four corners or swept away by the smallest breath as insubstantial. Did you not know what the Holy One can do with dust?" I did not know, and we did not. In their own ways, other shepherds, Scott Sanders, my longtime colleague, and Alan Tsai, our weekly therapist for so long, were powerful shepherds for me at Joseph's house. I learned from Scott to get fierce about what I love. Scott came of age in ACT UP, the early vehicle for gay men's militant resistance to the inadequate resources dedicated to cure AIDS. His advocacy for our residents and for Joseph's house well-being was fierce. He helped me to see how much harder it can be to get well and stay alive, maybe even harder than dying. He showed me that the distance we at Joseph's house can go with someone could be a longer distance than I had imagined. And thanks to him, to Scott, our program grew to include subsidized housing for those of our residents who get well in Jubilee buildings with strong Joseph's House support and case management. Someone somewhere wrote that pilgrims of old braved the elements, brave danger and uncertainty because they were intentionally seeking something valuable. At Joseph's house, we're seeking something valuable. And I'm just putting in a word here for Alan Tsai, who accompanies us and our leadership team every week to help us stay real and honest, and helped Scott and me stay together as long as we did before he took a job at the National Cathedral. So I'm coming to the last part of my sharing with you. I'm aware that my voice is soft. You can only hear me because I'm standing up and have this microphone, and I can't seem to change that. But I really hope you can feel, I hope you can feel my love. I hope you'll just listen a little while longer, because what I want to share matters so much to me. It's kind of it's sort of a love letter in a way. So, about 10 years after Joseph's House opened and Mary Daniel and Lois and David had all moved on, and I was the director, Joseph's House began to fall apart. An important issue that we couldn't seem to resolve was that of religious freedom of expression, including freedom from any religious expression. Spirituality and religion, for the group of staff working there at the time, spirituality and religion were synonymous. And some of the aides actually strongly resented us even saying the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer. Well, dying, being together, is not a medical event. It's a spiritual part of our journey. And there was a depth of conflict and a way of handling the conflict amongst the staff that I had no idea how to participate in and resolve. And I blame myself because they didn't do it as long as David was there. But I knew I couldn't go on this way. I didn't like the atmosphere that the men with AIDS were still dying, still coming into at that time, but I didn't know what to do about it. So then I came across a notice on the internet for a year-long training in San Francisco in a contemplative way of being with dying at the San Francisco Zen Hospice. And it really asked for a lot from the participants. It asked for a 4-day weekend training every month for 12 months and 2 10-day silent retreats. The board of directors backed me up. I participated and I brought back to Joseph's House what I was learning. I was longing for this. Taught without dogma by Buddhists who had accompanied hundreds and hundreds of men and women as they died. I learned practices for deeper listening. I learned to listen a little deeper to myself and to others and to grow, how we can grow in awareness of ourselves and become aware of being attracted to somebody or being not attracted, totally disinterested in someone, and you just ask yourself, well, why? And as we ask ourselves why, when we notice, it means that we can choose that intentional reaching out in love. It's not about a feeling, it's with intention. And then the person who is so sick that they're there doesn't have to have the extra load of being liked by me to get good care from me. That happens in hospitals all the time. The hardest people to communicate get left alone. And it's the responsibility of us, the caregivers, to know ourselves, to know why we're attracted or not attracted. And it's not usually a grumpiness. It really matters that we cultivate that kind of skillful compassion, and we do at Joseph's House. And it changes our community. It's still changing our community. So what I learned is that the followers of Jesus who founded Joseph's House from here, from Eighth Day, were motivated to love, to be in solidarity, to do justice, to be compassionate with homeless men with AIDS at the time. That was the gospel message that they were responding to. And over time, that was the why Joseph's House. And over time, it became that the question of how do we stay in this became really relevant. How do we grow in compassion and grow in awareness? How do we stay? And the how for me, for us, was definitely helped by the things that we've been learning all these years, starting with the Zen Hospice project, that the how. But also there's some part of it for me is knowing that, oh, the things I learned, the challenges I faced, the nightmare inward-looking journey I had as a live-in volunteer at Daybreak years before in L'Arche really helped me to know it really helped me to know that in our everydayness we can meet God in each other. So I'm going to say, I think I'm just going to skip some of the stuff that was so precious to me to tell you, but I don't know how long I've been talking, so let me just keep going.
Go for it, Patty.
Go for it? Okay, let me flip back this page. Okay, I'm so glad you invited me to do that, because this really changed my life. Well, I was just about going to put it over here. I met a shepherdess whose name is Blossom Williams, and her question to me was, her statement was, I always knew they would. That was her statement. Blossom, it was a long time ago, 6 years ago, Sunday, July 14th, 2013. I remember it. And it was a Sunday morning at Joseph's house. We were lingering over a second cup of coffee. It had been a wonderful breakfast. Table was crowded, and I was sitting beside Blossom, who's originally from Jamaica, my longtime colleague. We knew each other very well. I was kind of keeping the conversation going, you know, how we do sometimes. The night before, there'd been a news broadcast that a jury found George Zimmerman not guilty in the murder of young Trayvon Martin in Florida. So at the table that morning, in the conversation I put out into the mix, I can't believe they let that guy off. Blossom, who was sitting right beside me, wiped tears from her face and whispered, I always knew they would, that they would let him off. And I was so surprised by the difference in our responses to Zimmerman's acquittal. I was shocked by what Blossom knew and I didn't know. And there and then, I had this image of my worldview as a tiny umbrella, so tiny, held above me, it only covered me. It couldn't even reach over to cover Blossom, and she was sitting so close to me. I knew immediately that I needed help to enlarge my worldview about race. Nothing had ever felt more urgent. I called David. I told him what had happened, and I remember telling him that I knew no African Americans who were not dependent on me for a job or for their care. I didn't know how to meet African American people as peers to whom I could really listen, with whom I could actually talk about race. And I asked him to help me, and he did. With David's introduction, I was invited to a mission group with African American people and white people that met weekly to pray and talk about the effects of race in our lives, and doing so, get to know each other quite deeply. Even trust each other some. And since that time, I've been privileged and grateful to explore the mostly unconscious racism within myself and the structural racism and within our society and, of course, at Joseph's house. I've been privileged to be very uncomfortable in many different settings when the conversation is about race, to listen and be humbled and grow as a human being. 6 years after that morning at Joseph's house, at the table beside Blossom, my worldview is larger. My worldview is larger, and it's still growing. On this pilgrim journey with Joseph's house, I've become aware of so much within me that is so deeply in need of repair. you know, I love the poet and artist Jan Richardson. And she writes that most of the repairs that we're called to make in life are small, incremental, and cumulative. When big transformations happen in a heart, in a relationship, in a worldview, in a community, in a country, they typically come from these small repairs. Restoration, she says, relies on our willingness to engage. Oh, this is so hard. The slow work of mending over time. It takes us to approach each part of it as a practice, to turn toward what is broken, to imagine what it could become, discern our role in its healing, and enter into the rhythms that will support its restoration. The point is not to erase every sign of damage. The point in part is to show that the damage doesn't have the final word. What finally emerges from the mending will be both scarred and beautiful. And most of all, it will be whole. David White, another poet, says that as pilgrims, we are by definition someone abroad in a world of impending revelation, where something is just about to happen, including just around the corner, and as part of our eventual arrival, our own disappearance. I believe he may be speaking about our dying and our death. There is a way in which I am aware of myself dying. My pilgrim path continues, but not for much longer at Joseph's house. I will leave this place that has guided me into life more abundant than I had ever dreamed of, where I have had so much help, visible and invisible shepherdesses and shepherds along the way. This summer, I'll return to Western Canada, to the city of Calgary near the Rocky Mountains in the province of Alberta, where my mother still lives in my childhood home. She lives alone, and she's 95 now. My mother always set me free, always set me free. And now she needs my companionship to be able to stay in the home she loves, as long as she wants to and can. I may not have been blessed exactly as I started on my pilgrim journey when I left home at 17. But as that sweet gospel song goes, which I put over there, but I'm gonna sing a cappella, my mother prayed for me, had me on her mind. I'm so glad she prayed for me. I'm so glad she prayed for me. And she's still praying for me, and I want to be there for her, and it's time. David White, the poet, says, and I think he knows what he's talking about, the way we give ourselves to the pilgrim path as an ultimate invitation into vulnerability and arrival is a form of faith. The way we give ourselves to the pilgrim path as an ultimate invitation into vulnerability and arrival is a form of faith. Never fully knowing what lies on the other side, or if we'll survive it in any recognizable form. Strangely, he says, our arrival at that last transition along the way is exactly where we will have the perspective to understand who has been traveling all along. I didn't begin my pilgrim journey knowing myself beloved. I was loved, yes, indeed, but I didn't know myself, beloved. I can feel that I'm closer to that today after so many heartfelt days and nights at Joseph's house. And I wonder if you would allow me to end by sharing a poem that was really written for the beginning of Lent. And it moves me. It's about setting out on our pilgrim way into what looks like and sometimes it really is the wilderness, and knowing ourselves beloved as we set forth. Beloved is where we begin. Beloved is where we begin. If you would enter into the wilderness, do not begin without a blessing. Do not begin without a blessing. Do not leave without hearing who you are, beloved, named by the one who has traveled this path before you. Do not go without letting it echo in your ears. And if it's hard to let it into your heart, do not despair. That is what this journey is for. I can't promise this blessing will free you from danger, from fear, from hunger, from thirst, from loneliness, from regret, from self-doubt, from the scorching of sun or the fall of the night. But I can tell you that on this path, there will be help. And I can tell you that on this way, there will be rest. I can tell you that you will know the strange graces that come to our aid only on a road such as this, that fly to meet us, that bearing comfort and strength, that fly to meet us bearing comfort and strength, that come alongside us for no other cause than to lean themselves toward our ear, and with their curious insistence, whisper our name, beloved, beloved, beloved.